Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, groundbreaking cancer research and new secrets about the universe, we review the latest in science. Then we revisit the American Revolution through the story of the Loyalists, those who fought on the side of Great Britain. Finally, the Senate has begun hearings to amend the U.S. Constitution as an effort to overturn a Supreme Court decision, Citizens United. But it's not the only effort to amend the Constitution. We'll explore the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. Scientists are making great strides in better understanding cancer, Alzheimer's disease, and disorders such as PTSD. Meanwhile, other scientists are making new discoveries about our own galaxy and solar system. With us to explore these highlights is Fred Gutterl. He is the executive editor of Scientific American. Welcome, Fred Gutterl. It's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm delighted to be back.
Scientific American did a big special on cancer, and it seems like it's a very exciting time for cancer research.
It is. This was a big project that our colleagues at Nature magazine put together, and we worked on it together and ran it in Scientific American. And there's been a war on it for decades, and there's now really some pretty good signs that progress is being made.
Certainly, historically, people died of things like infections, and then the medical community realized that they could treat infections, and people died less of that, and now they tend to die more of things like heart disease and cancer, and now we're making huge strides in that, too.
That's exactly right. And people often ask me, you know, why, if I'm concerned about the rise in cancer, you're right to point out that it's longevity. As longevity increases and you eliminate things that people used to die of, what's left are the harder problems, which is cancer among them.
One of the things that I noticed in the special issue of Scientific American was that every cancer has a sort of weak spot, like a genetic vulnerability. And it seems like the trick that scientists are looking for now is finding that. Can you give us a sense of what they're finding?
Cancer is subject to the laws of evolution in a way that, like any organism is, I mean, cancer is not an organism, but it behaves in certain ways, and it wouldn't exist widely if there weren't certain qualities that it had. And everything has a weakness. And the key, I think, here is that the genomic revolution has really made it much less expensive to sequence the DNA of individual cells. Now that scientists are able to do this to cancer cells, then you can begin to probe the DNA for specific behaviors and specific vulnerabilities.
Are these what they're calling precision approaches?
That's right. The idea basically is to take a look at the genetic makeup of a tumor and then come up with a therapy that works specifically to that tumor. And scientists think that eventually every form of cancer may have its own particular therapy. Therapies like chemotherapy and radiation therapy are very blunt instruments. So, and one of the reasons they make people so sick is they kill a lot of healthy cells in an effort to kill the tumor cells. So if you can hone in on the specific genes that are at work in tumor cells, then you can target them. So that would involve a lot less collateral damage.
And then the other area that seems to be really big for development is this immunotherapy.
Yeah, this is just a broad way of looking at the interaction between cancer cells and the body's own immune system. Think of it in evolutionary terms. Cancer thrives because it takes advantages of weaknesses in the immune system. So it can hide from the immune system or it can disguise itself or whatever. And this is true with disease as well. You know, malaria, which is a really old human disease, the parasite that causes malaria is very clever about hiding from the immune system until it's ready. And cancer kind of does the same thing. And if you can get specifically at how this interaction occurs between the immune system and the cancer cells, then you can figure out ways of getting the body's own immune system to work against the cancer cells.
The other piece that you published that was so fascinating was that there's this little creature that doesn't get cancer. It's called a naked mole rat.
Yeah, no, naked mole rats are interesting creatures in that they don't seem to get cancer. In the same way, you can analyze the genomic data of a tumor cell. You can analyze the genomic data of a naked mole rat and figure out what is the mechanism in the naked mole rat which keeps tumor cells from growing out of control. cancerous tumor are just cells that are multiplying without any limit. And it turns out that there are a couple of genes that they have that serve to limit the growth of cells. So perhaps there's a clue there to some kind of therapy for some types of cancer. It's all very early stages. It's one of those things where if we look at what nature does, then we can figure out different strategies.
Let's turn to some of the neuroscience. One of the most fascinating articles I thought had to do with anxiety, PTSD, and how they're related to neurons. The current issue is explaining how, as we're adults, we're growing these new neurons, and new nerve cells can help with these things. How does this all work?
This is not all that easy to get your head around, pardon the pun. It's a weird kind of combination of things. You know, basically, when the brain acquires a memory, and you think of it in terms of neurons, it's a pattern, right? So your brain is holding all these patterns in its head, which we call memories. And one of the things that the brain has to do is it has to make subtle distinctions between different memories. Because if you don't distinguish between memories, then you're going to be doing some very strange things. And people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder kind of have this jumbled memory problem. So you hear a loud noise and you respond to it as you would a mortar shell. So if you think of PTSD as a kind of jumbled memory syndrome, then if you encourage the brain to get better at distinguishing these patterns, then you could conceivably come up with a treatment for it. And it turns out that there are only a couple of regions of the brain that can generate new brain cells even into adulthood. So, you know, when you're a kid, you know, when you're really an infant, your brain grows at an enormous rate, making new connections. And then at fairly early age, that growth kind of stops and your brain starts to pare down on the number of connections it's got. Well, there are exceptions to this. There are areas where new neurons are being generated throughout your life. And it turns out that these same areas are what help us distinguish one memory from another. So if you have somebody who is mistaking a garbage truck for a mortar shell and suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, if you boost the brain's ability to grow new neurons, you could conceivably help them get over that syndrome. I think this is all pretty theoretical. You know, it's not a treatment. We're talking about really basic neuroscience here. But it's interesting.
The research they've been doing on things like meditation and mindfulness and how it relates to the neurons, it starts to make sense that this helps with people who might have had PTSD.
The brain is a very complex organ. It's the most complex object that we know about. I mean, it's incredibly complex. And the fact that we each have one is pretty amazing. So mindfulness, meditation, they're very, really flavor of the month. And I think the connection between meditation and PTSD and new neurons, that's not a scientific connection. But I think that there are ways where a lot of phenomena that involve the brain are connected, and we're only just beginning to understand them. I mean, it's all connections. I mean, the brain is all connections.
In that article, it was something about whenever you have anxiety, it shuts down the creation of the new neurons. And so when you then do these mindfulness things that kind of calm you down, then it could allow you to generate the new neurons. Last thing on the human health side was this article about Alzheimer's disease being connected to Down syndrome, that they have certain similarities. Can you tell us what they found?
This is a story about a similarity that scientists saw between patients with Alzheimer's disease and Down syndrome children. And Down syndrome, people have an extra copy of chromosome 21, and the gene that codes for the protein that is present in Alzheimer's patients is also found on that same chromosome. So they were speculating that there may be a link there, that what happens in Down syndrome patients could be somehow similar to what happens later in life to Alzheimer's patients.
Well, let's move to the bigger macro space side of things. There are new discoveries about the Milky Way.
This is pretty incredible. You look at the Milky Way, when you look up in the sky, you see this band of light. And you're basically looking edgeward on the galaxy. We're at the rim of the galaxy, and we're looking in. It's like being a fly on the edge of a Frisbee. And you're looking in, and you're seeing the Frisbee flat. Now, if you look right in the middle of that, you know, that whiteness, there's a black hole. You can't see the black hole because it's black, but it's there. This is a really interesting story of how astronomers can look at things and they try to explain things that they find by process of elimination. So they got this image of the center of the Milky Way, and then they subtracted the dust, the signal that they thought was probably dust, and then they subtracted another signal that they thought was the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is really the reverberation of the Big Bang. So it's this basically like the universe is ringing like a bell, and it makes this constant sound, except it's not sound, it's electromagnetic waves. And so they removed that. And then they thought, well, maybe we still had a signal. There's still something out there. And they thought, well, maybe that's dark matter. And dark matter is a form of matter that is theoretical, but is thought to exist because there are gravitational effects that can only be explained by more matter than what we can visibly see. From what we think we know about dark matter, that there would be another kind of gamma ray radiation from that. And so what they did was they then looked to eliminate that possibility. They went to another type of satellite that detects gamma rays, and they eliminated dark matter from what could explain this signal. And what they came up with was that, you know, there are these giant bubbles that are coming out from perpendicular to the plane of the Frisbee on either end. So you got the Frisbee going from left to right, and then from, you know, up and down, you've got these giant bubbles of cosmic rays coming out. And you can't see them, but you can detect them. And we didn't know they were there until recently, and we can't fully explain them. But it's just an example to me of how little we know about the universe around us and, you know, the night sky. And it's remarkable to me that you can find giant bubbles coming out of the Milky Way that no one had found before.
That are gargantuan.
Oh, they're like many, many times the size of the solar system.
And speaking of the solar system, Saturn may have a new moon.
It's a potential new moon. There is a bright spot in an image from the Cassini spacecraft that passed Saturn a few years ago. And what they think we're seeing is a moon that's in the process of being formed. The rings are really kind of gas and dust that are swirling around, and they form a ring shape. And then the dust and gas start to coalesce around a point. So maybe there's a rock or something kind of large, and then the rock exerts a little bit of gravitational force on the dust and gas around it, and then the dust and gas falls into the rock, and then it, you know, it starts to accrete more mass, and then it has more gravity, and gradually it starts to form solid objects, so it's a moon. And so what they think they're seeing is a moon in the process of being formed. And it's very exciting because we've never seen that before. And how does that happen, and what does it look like, and are our ideas about how that happens correct?
Saturn already has, 60, 62 moons, something like that?
Yeah, it's hard to keep track. They keep finding new ones. I mean, the solar system has changed so much since when I was a kid. You know, we lost Pluto, but we gained all these Kuiper belt objects, and Saturn used to have only, I don't know what it had when I was a kid, 9 moons or 10 moons, and now it has dozens and dozens of them.
And it sounded like from the article that these moons form in these rings, but they're also highly vulnerable because they're small and can get pulverized by some other object.
Exactly. A moon starts to form and then something could happen to disturb it. So until it accretes enough mass to really become a solid object, then you can't really call it a moon. And even large moons can get bumped or destroyed, but the larger the moon, the less likely it is to suffer that fate.
Well, Fred Gutterl, it's great to have you back here. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Maria.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Who were the tens of thousands of people who remained loyal to Britain during the American Revolutionary War, and what happened to them? Among the 1/4 of all American colonists who decided to stay loyal to the king in 1776, there were at least 20,000 slaves and free people of African descent. Where did they go after the war? And what do their stories tell us about American history? We're joined by Harvard history professor Maya Jasanoff, and we're talking about her latest book, Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary War. Welcome, Maya Jasanoff.
great to speak with you.
It's great to have you. So you have been looking at this aspect of American and British history that hasn't been looked at really very closely, and that is that there was a very large, what we call loyalist community, that is people that were loyal to the British crown, during the American Revolution. And it wasn't really a small number. Tell us about this community.
A lot of Americans don't realize that our revolution was really a civil war. It was our first civil war. And it was a war that divided people up and down the colonies as they were then around the question of whether to be independent. And so for the average American at the beginning of the American Revolution, the default position was actually to stay loyal to Britain. And up to maybe a third of Americans are believed to have being loyal to Britain throughout the war, not necessarily gone along with the patriot vision of independence and freedom and so on that we think of as having been so widespread in retrospect. But for them, really, staying with the status quo, staying with Britain was something that was very powerful and important to them.
That brings up a few questions. One is really the role of people like Thomas Paine, who allegedly was this person who reframed the entire idea of independence and revolution in a way that made it seem honorable rather than treasonous. So apparently it didn't work with all people. Why do you think that is?
I think that Thomas Paine, who was himself British, did do something amazing for Americans, as did Thomas Jefferson in the opening of the Declaration of Independence. And I think that they put a language to the cause of independence that had not been there before and that really gave American patriots a rhetorical advantage over Britain in the Revolution. That said, rhetoric is not the same as daily life, and it doesn't put food on your table, and it doesn't look after your family, and it doesn't govern the kinds of relationships that you have in your home, in your business, and all the rest of it. And so I think for many people living in the colonies at that time, while this rhetoric was very, very seductive and obviously went on to have a great resonance in and beyond our nation, there was still a powerful sense of the ways in which they wanted to have lives for themselves that could have profit and could have political coherence and could protect them from threats around the world. And those were all goals that many Americans continued to see held out for them in the crown of Britain and remaining part of the British Empire.
You noted that a lot of the people were members of the Anglican Church. Many of them were connected to the imperialists. But there were other kinds of loyalists there as well. It seemed like there was a diversity of them, including the people of African descent, something like you said, 20,000 slaves, and also free people of African descent. Talk about the various kinds of loyalists, so-called loyalists, and
sure,
their various reasons.
We in America usually think of loyalists as having belonged to a very small elite, as having been predominantly white men in positions of power, Anglican, strong ties to Britain, wealthy for the most part. This was in fact only a subset of who loyalists were, just as it was only a subset of who Americans were. And one of the things that is really important to know about loyalism at this time is that it cut right across the spectrum of early America. It cut across the ethnic spectrum, the geographical spectrum, the religious spectrum, and the spectrum of occupations and all the rest of it. So people had their own reasons for staying loyal that could come out of belief, pragmatic calculation, and also opportunities. And this is where the story of group of African Americans called the Black Loyalists is particularly fascinating and important, I think, for us to look at. We know that in the United States there was this wonderful language of freedom, independence, liberty, that celebrated by Paine and Jefferson and more, but it didn't extend, of course, to the 500,000 slaves who were held in the U.S. at that time. Instead, many of them saw liberty offered to them by the British Empire, and early in the war, just a few months after the American Revolution began, British commanders began issuing promises to patriot-owned slaves in Virginia and elsewhere, telling them that if they came and joined the British, then they would get freedom in exchange for doing that. And so for them, the promise of liberty was really held out by Britain and the Empire, and about 20,000 black slaves ended up joining the British, and a good half of them survived the war and ended up being evacuated in freedom at the war's end to live out liberty in the British world.
And there were also several thousand of the free people of African descent as well.
Yes, and in particular, these slaves who became free as a result of British promises. And British commanders really, in quite an admirable gesture that I think has been neglected by historians, really stuck up for the freedom of these people in the face of great American opposition. And in fact, George Washington himself confronted the British commander at the end of the war, saying, "You guys are taking away our property," as he saw the former slaves. And the British commander stood up and said, "Look, you know, these are free people, and I'm not going to take their freedom away from them." And George Washington was very put out by this. Not least, some of his own former slaves went off into the British Empire and had new lives. But the fact is that Washington's vision of freedom and liberty did not apply to and did not extend to these formerly enslaved people.
So given the extent of the people that were loyalists, you said it was one-third of the people settling in America. That's a huge number. So what accounts for, you've got the British Army, which was very strong. You've got one-third of the people living there siding with the British Army, and they still lost.
Yes, it is one of the great what-if questions in certainly British imperial history. There are really a couple of things that account for why loyalists didn't win the day. And I do think that that rhetorical advantage that the U.S. had was very powerful. And I also think, and this comes back to the issue of civil war, at the end of the day, British people living in Britain and colonists of British extraction living in the 13 colonies shared more than divided them. And when faced with this potentially protracted, bloody, divisive war, I think many people on both sides really had a kind of lack of will to keep fighting it out when they could find ways to redefine the relationship peacefully. So by the time the Americans had this kind of coherent sense of who they were going to be, the British were interested in trying to find a kind of common ground with what became the United States.
Now, here in the U.S., we are taught about the spirit of 76. You talk about the spirit of 1783. Tell us about that.
So one of the great paradoxes about the American Revolution is that Britain lost this war. It was the biggest loss of territory for the British Empire until the era of World War II, until the whole empire fell apart in the 20th century. And yet, it was Britain, not the United States, that went on to be the big world power throughout the 19th century, up until, in fact, about World War II. So how could it be that Britain lost these colonies, these closest possessions, very valuable culturally and politically, nevertheless go on to kind of new heights? And the answer, I suggest, is that they took away lessons from losing in America. And those lessons, I think, were summed up in what I call the spirit of 1783. And they included a new sense, really, of how to manage relations between the government and the people, and to manage them in ways that meant that people of all kinds of religions and ethnicities living all around the world could find a place within the hierarchy of the empire. They would have liberty up to a point. They would be held in check by institutions of the crown and its officers. And in this kind of balance, you saw a form of government that actually proved remarkably resilient and successful around the world. And it was the experience of having lost the colonies where this kind of balance didn't work out for Britain that helped them figure out where to go next and come up with what turned out to be a very successful formula moving forward into the 19th and 20th centuries.
It worked for a little while.
150-odd years is not so bad as a run of things at the top of the world.
And so I understand that this loyalism versus patriotism really did break up families, communities, other relations. How prevalent was this kind of division that occurred?
I think it was a lot more prevalent than we generally think, again. And the best example of this kind of division can be found in one of our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, whose own son, William Franklin, ended up being a very powerful leading loyalist, as important to the loyalist community as Benjamin Franklin was to the Patriot community. And here was a rift between father and son created by the war. And so while Benjamin Franklin was managing American affairs diplomatically through the war and ultimately negotiated the peace settlements that defined U.S. independence, William Franklin was arrested by the Patriots, jailed for some time, spent time in British-occupied New York City organizing Loyalist resistance to Patriot forces, and ended up spending the end of the war himself in exile in Britain and ending up on the losing side. But the passions that were ignited by this war were, I think, very strong, and the principles people had in the case of the Franklins, you know, could be very powerful, and it really could divide even this very close father and son. We tend to think of ourselves as having always been a very united people, but to remember the ways in which we weren't always united is very important for us as we live through an era of seeming partisanship in our country today.
The big question that arose for me is how this history impacts our understanding of historic America and the founding of America. What would you say the impact is?
There are two aspects to this that I really believe are important. One is that America really was based on wonderful principles and promises and rhetoric, and yet we have never been a monolithic society. We have always been a society with many, many voices, very plural, very multi-ethnic. I believe that that's very much a source of our strength, but it's also, of course, been a source of tension historically right the way through our national history, the Civil War being a great example. So the importance of remembering that even at the outset, we had all kinds of divisions might make it easier for us somehow to accept that we're going to continue to be divided, and that's part of what makes us who we are. We share some values, we're going to debate them, and we're going to fight about them, and that's part of what we're about. The second point is also very important for America right now, and that is that we have long really been proud of what makes our national history so special and so distinctive. But our national history has always been in a larger international context. And you know, one of the things about the Loyalist refugees is that American influences through these people ended up spreading out across the world. And it's just a really important reminder that our history has always been bound up with the histories of other nations.
Maya Jazanoff, thank you so much for being with us. The name of the book is Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World.
Great to talk with you.
When we come back, we'll explore the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Last April, U.S. Senator Tom Udall began the process to amend the U.S. Constitution in an effort to allow Congress to pass campaign finance reform. In June, the Senate Judiciary Committee began hearings. Meanwhile, citizens in other states have begun a movement to call for a constitutional convention. What is the likelihood of either of these occurring? And what are the various processes that others have used in past amendments? We have three constitutional experts with us. Sanford Levinson joins us. He is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, and more recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Also with us is John Vile. John Vile is Dean and Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, and The forthcoming Reframers, 170 Eccentric Visionary and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Also with us is Stephen Griffin. He is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane Law School. He's the author of Long Wars in the Constitution and American Constitutionalism from Theory to Politics. Welcome to the three of you. Great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. One senator, Tom Udall, began the process of amending in an effort to allow Congress to pass campaign finance reform. Let's start with the process of amending the U.S. Constitution. And what is the likelihood of an amendment like this succeeding? Stephen Griffin?
I would just point out that in talking to John and Sandy, you're talking to two of the greatest constitutional amendment mavens in the country. I would cast this on a much broader plane than just Citizens United and say that maybe it would be surprising to some, but there is somewhat of a latent consensus in the country that some kind of fundamental political reforms should be made. That doesn't mean people agree, of course, but it also doesn't mean that amendment is the only way to get there. Now, because of Citizens United, that has highlighted the issue of some decisions, the Supreme Court decisions, you can only overturn through amendment. But that's not really true of all of them. The constitutional system can work in funny ways. The general observation I would start with, since Sandy and John are so much greater experts on this than I am, is that the traditional graveyard of constitutional amendments is not the states, it's Congress. You know, thousands of amendments, and we only have very few passed on to the states, and most of the amendments that have been passed on to the states have been ratified. So the big graveyard here is the supermajority rule. That's in Article 5, that requires a supermajority of the House and the Senate for any amendment to go forward.
Sandy Levinson, you have been very critical about Article 5. Why don't you put this into context for us?
You're absolutely right. Not to put too fine a point on it, I despise Article 5 because it makes it, as a practical matter, next to impossible to amend the Constitution with regard to anything that is controversial, and some people might argue even with regard to things that are genuinely important. So I think, to answer part of your question, the odds of Senator Udall being successful are zero. There is no conceivable scenario under which two-thirds of the House and the Senate will vote to overrule Citizens United, which has this very strong support of almost all Republicans, just as Republicans generally have been cheerleaders for all of the cases that have gutted campaign finance reform. So I think that whatever one's views on the substance of Citizens United, and even if one wants to express some support for Senator Udall, it really is like throwing a message into the ocean and expecting that somebody on the other side will find it.
John Vile?
I wouldn't quite go that far. Let's start with some facts. We have 27 amendments. Steve was exactly right. We have about 12,000 proposals that have been introduced in Congress. 33 were actually proposed to the states. 27 of those were ratified. So he's absolutely right. The Congress, and particularly the Senate, is sort of the graveyard for amendments. I suppose a defender of the current decisions in the Supreme Court might argue that this is actually a testament to the power of the First Amendment, which, once adopted, takes on a life of its own and is very difficult to amend. And we've only had one amendment repealed. I would say the only amendment that has significantly reduced civil liberties, the 18th Amendment, has been subsequently repealed. The other side of this is that there are some people who believe that speech and money are closely tied, and are very grateful to have a system where the government cannot, and particularly where incumbents in office who tend to perpetuate themselves and for whom we do not have term limits other than for the president, often have a tremendous advantage over challengers. And I think there are many who think that the Supreme Court has actually been in the right direction.
Let's back up and do a little bit more historic context then. You've given us some numbers. How hard has it been historically to pass these 27 amendments? Were some of them not as hard? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Sandy Levinson?
I think that the easy ones to pass are where the country realized, or those actually in charge of state legislatures realized, that they made a great deal of sense. One of my favorite amendments that is almost never taught because there's no litigation about it is the 20th Amendment. The 20th Amendment is a great, great addition to the Constitution. It moved up Inauguration Day from March 4th to January 20th because I think by 1933 everybody agreed that it was crazy to have this five-month period between election and the inauguration of a new president who might very well have defeated an incumbent. So, in effect, we really didn't have a functioning government for several months. I'm very critical of keeping January 20th, but still, we got rid of March 4th. The other thing the 20th Amendment did was to get rid of what we now realize was a lunatic feature of the Constitution in terms of its practical operation. And, in fact, this even came up in the recess appointment case yesterday, that under the original Constitution, Congress met only once a year in December. And so you could have literally 13 months go by between the election of a new Congress and the first time the new Congress, as against the lame duck Congress, would meet. This really made no sense by 1933, you know, regardless of what you thought earlier in our history, and the 20th Amendment got rid of that so that new Congresses now meet in January. The Presidential Disability Amendment raced through. Actually, the 17th Amendment, which is a very important amendment, raced through because the resistance to popular election of senators really was in the Senate itself, but by the time the Senate acquiesced to public opinion and the threat of a constitutional convention, which I'd like to say more about in a few minutes, it then raced through the states because most of the states had, in effect, adopted de facto a popular election.
Sandy Levinson, for people who don't know that the 17th Amendment changed the way we elect our senators, we used to select them by state legislatures, and 17th Amendment made it popular election.
And actually, there are those today associated with the Tea Party, or for that matter, Texas Governor Rick Perry, who believed the 17th Amendment was a mistake and should be repealed, and we should go back to selection by state legislatures. But the point in terms of our discussion right now is that it did basically race through. The Equal Rights Amendment is a very, very interesting example of an amendment that was thought to be, you know, a quickly ratified amendment. Something like 32 or 33 states, John would know the exact number because there really is nobody in the country who knows more about constitutional amendment than John Vile. But, you know, a lot of states ratified it very quickly, and then Phyllis Schlafly generated the quite remarkable social movement against the ERA, and as we know, even after a three-year addition to the original seven-year ratification period, it still wasn't successful. But generally speaking, though, you know, I stand ready to be corrected by John, I think that constitutional amendments either succeed fairly quickly or they go down.
John Vile?
He's absolutely right. ERA, if I remember correctly, got up to 35 states, and probably 32 of them, you know, were within the first 6 months, and I'm just pulling that out of thin air. But what I see in the amending process is I don't think that the last 10 years are necessary, or 20 years are necessarily characteristic of, I don't think it's time to do a postmortem on the amending process. If you look at our history, we had 12 that were adopted relatively quickly, two within 2 years of the meeting of the first 10, you know, adopted as a package pretty much in 1791. Then we had a dry spell, 1803 to 1865. And, you know, I think a lot of it during that time is part of the situation now. We really didn't have a consensus on some of the major issues. I mean, we have people very passionately believing that we need campaign limits and others just as passionately believing otherwise. There was a prominent Princeton professor, I suppose still is, who opposed or thought we needed a traditional marriage amendment. There are probably just as many people now who believe that we should have an amendment, you know, providing for gay marriage. And we had something similar, you know, 1868 to 1913, we had no amendments. And then we got four amendments adopted in a relatively quick period, you know, reflected the progressive eras. I do get the feeling that there is a rising sort of tide of people who are willing to reconsider the Article 5 convention mechanism. The first book I ever wrote was on proposals to rewrite the Constitution, and I came up, that was in 1991, and I came up with like 40 proposals. I have a book coming out at the end of next month called Reframers, in which I discovered about 175. And the sad thing is I've discovered probably another 20 since the book was written. They seem to be coming out one or two a month now. And some of them, it's titled Eccentric, Visionary, and Patriotic Proposals, and some of them probably fit the eccentric more than they do the visionary. But nonetheless, there are people on, you know, all sides of the political spectrum who are, I think, starting to re-examine whether this might be a viable possibility.
John Vile, I think it was in your new book in which you outlined the times in which even presidents were advocating for changing. Sadie Levinson has also talked about in his work where right now we're in this state of it's really not appropriate to criticize the Constitution if you're an elected official, whereas historically we've had elected officials saying we need to make some changes.
Ronald Reagan and Gingrich and, you know, that group, part of what they were advocating, and, you know, sometimes you wonder if they really wanted an amendment or if they preferred to have the issues out there to argue about, but they favored anything from prayer in school to balanced budget and several other proposals.
Stephen Griffin, you looked a lot at the framers as well.
I see the same, roughly the same history that John Vile does through the 19th century. Might disagree, I don't know. On the 20th, suppose we define contemporary times as roughly the last 100 years, then we have distinct periods, that's right, where we get a bunch of amendments, and many of the most significant ones are passed in the progressive era. That's where we get not only direct election of senators and votes for women and prohibition too, but then later on it seems that the only amendments we pass, and the 1960s were themselves a significant period of constitutional change, at least in terms of amendments, but all of them are directed at pretty specific problems, where, as Sandy says, there's a consensus, and so they go through without much trouble. But the big outlier there is the ERA. I think the ERA bears study, because the ERA is the only recent example of an amendment, I'm happy to be corrected, that tried to put a principle into the Constitution rather than solve a specific problem, like the problem that Sandy referred to of the date of inauguration. Okay, that's a very specific problem. The ERA was trying to put a principle in the Constitution, and it was doing so at a time when people were very upset, some people, about the activism of the Supreme Court, and people started to think about what would it mean if the Supreme Court, in effect, got a hold of another general principle. So that has, to me, changed the situation. So it's not so easy anymore to think about broad-scale principled change through amendments. And I think Bruce Ackerman, another scholar who's written a lot about the amendment process, is accurate when he says we've got out of the habit of constitutional amendments, talking about them. And if that's true, and I think there's a lot of truth to that, the failure of the ERA was a big part of that. When that went down, a lot of the tradition of putting principles in the Constitution that arguably goes back to the Bill of Rights and Reconstruction, that kind of went down too, because any other principles, especially rights principles, would run into the same objection, namely, what's the Supreme Court going to do with that? Now, when I say that there could be a rising tide, I'm really not even talking, though, about principles in terms of rights. I mean, there's just a lot more interest in, we've got a dysfunctional political system, let's try to solve it. But at least that's something that, where if the amendment process were foreclosed by it's too difficult, it's a supermajority and all that, there are actually other ways to get at various problems of our political system other than through amendments. So it's not a hopeless quest. It's not the kind of the same hopeless quest that overturning Citizens United might be.
Before we discuss some of these dysfunctions, talk about these informal processes that can produce the kind of change. Obviously, it's not a formal process, but it seems to change the meaning of the Constitution rather than amending the actual Constitution. Would you say that's true?
I'm a big fan of studying informal change. There are certain things, of course, you can only do through amendment, but the filibuster is a really good example. It's a kind of tired example now, but it's a really good example of something that is absolutely not in the Constitution. It's not in the plan. It's really hard to make an argument even that more supermajoritarianism is good for the legislative process when it wasn't part of the plan to begin with. But at the same time, it is a historical practice. It's lasted a long time. So it's an institutional practice that suddenly changes. Because of changes in the political system, it metastasizes. It becomes much more significant than it ever was, and its very nature changes. It's not about Mr. Smith, Jimmy Stewart, you know, standing up and talking for 24 hours until he collapses. It's really an institutional change in the Senate where both sides are agreed, yeah, we're agreeing that you absolutely need 60 votes to move anything. And yet this happens without any public discussion. But that is a vulnerability for the people who like this. There are people who think that it's a good idea to have that kind of supermajoritarian principle. I don't obviously think it's a good idea at all, but that's a really good example of a pressure point, where if you got rid of it, a significant difference would result, and you can get rid of it without a constitutional amendment.
Sandy Levinson.
I think that your listeners ought to know that there is a very, very active campaign occurring throughout the country to generate an Article 5 constitutional convention through the petition of the states. When people think of Article 5, they almost invariably think of two-thirds of the Senate and the House, and then three-quarters of the states, but two-thirds of each House of Congress, because that, in fact, is how all the 27 amendments got to the states in the first place. But Article 5 very deliberately includes another pathway to proposal, which is through a constitutional convention that is called on petition of two-thirds of the states. There's an active campaign underway, largely dominated by political conservatives who want a balanced budget amendment. And they believe, quite correctly, that there is no real prospect of a balanced budget amendment getting through the Senate. The high point of that possibility was in the 1980s when they actually got two-thirds minus one. Mark Hatfield, the Republican senator from Oregon, voted against the proposal, and it didn't go to the states. I think most people believe that the current Congress would not, in fact, propose an amendment. But John might know the actual number of states who have filed petitions for an Article 5 convention. Now, it opens a huge Pandora's box of legal questions. Do all the states have to agree on every dotted I and crossed T on what the petition says? Most importantly, can states call for a limited convention that could consider only a balanced budget amendment, or would any convention be as open as the 1787 convention was to put everything on the table? My own view is that any convention is an unlimited convention. That doesn't bother me as much as it bothers most of my friends and family. But I can tell you that if we ever get to the 34th state that agrees that there ought to be a new convention for the purpose of considering a balanced budget amendment, then there would instantly be discussion and perhaps even litigation on whether the convention could be limited. And a number of the petitions, I believe, very explicitly say that the state legislature supports a new convention if and only if it can be limited. But this is going on right now. There are significant, substantial people, and I think money, being devoted to it. And I will say that as a person who doesn't share the conservative politics, I actually am kind of rooting this on because I think it would be very good to shake up public opinion and public discussion by having to discuss whether we need some genuinely fundamental change in the constitutional system. But don't forget state petitions. Congress might be hopeless, but state legislatures could turn out to be very, very interesting political actors in the next year or two.
John Vile.
I really appreciate my colleagues and how complimentary they've been. I actually disagree with Sandy in believing that we could have a limited convention, although there are a lot of ifs, ands, and buts, and a lot of complications. One thing that I think is interesting that maybe is even under the radar of what we're seeing, although the balanced budget is sort of the tip of the spear in the calls for conventions, I have found it surprising how many people also really want to reconfigure federalism. And, of course, many people would argue that what they're trying to do is get back to the founders. But, I mean, there are proposals that Supreme Court justices from the states could, within a year, revoke federal legislation. There are any number of proposals like that that are also part of this movement. And I do think that it's a fairly strong movement. That being said, we've had at least three occasions on history where we got close and didn't do it. And one was the 17th Amendment, and some people think it was one of the prompts for Congress. But then there was a similar movement in the 1960s in reaction to the reapportionment decision. And then, as Sandy says, you know, particularly right now, the balanced budget and other federal concerns are very prominent.
You've all mentioned the states and the actions that the states can take. I know that some states and cities have been passing resolutions along these lines. The state of California passed a resolution, I think, recently supporting a constitutional amendment to try to overturn the Supreme Court opinion via constitutional amendment. Is this significant at all, Sandy?
I got in the mail today an issue of the Arkansas Law Review that published a lecture that I gave last year on what I call neo-nullification, and for that matter, neo-secessionism, that is alive and well in the United States today. By neo-nullification, I mean attempts by state legislatures in particular, but also some city councils, to do whatever they can to make enforcement of federal law impossible. Some of them quite grandiosely, and I think altogether implausibly, believe that they do have the authority genuinely to nullify a federal law, and I think that's nonsense. But Heather Gerken, who teaches at the Yale Law School, coined the term uncooperative federalism, which I think is a wonderful term because it gets at the reality that the modern American state depends for its effective administration on the willingness of states and localities to be part of the same governmental team. And to the extent that, well, my own city of Austin is considering a proposal, which I frankly support, to stop cooperating with federal immigration authorities with regard to holding illegal aliens who have been arrested for a traffic violation or something else, so that the federal authorities can round them up and then deport them. New Orleans, where Steve lives, I think also has engaged in the same kind of resistance. It's not what John Calhoun would have called nullification, but I think that this is an important aspect of contemporary politics where at times it really is hard to tell the players without a scorecard in terms of traditional left-right divisions, that on gun policy, it's the right wing that wants to declare that federal gun laws are unenforceable. But with regard to immigration policy, you are discovering that there are some people associated with the left who say, now, wait a minute, we should do whatever we can to torpedo federal legislation that the Supreme Court, no doubt, believes is perfectly constitutional.
Stephen Griffin.
The common pattern here is that because of dysfunction, gridlock, whatever you want to call it, at the national level, there's a lot of policy ferment going on in the states. And immigration is a really good example of where it maybe trends a little liberal out of frustration of non-action. But a lot of it is conservative, and you didn't have, let's say, a big budget agreement getting us back on the road, let's say, to surpluses. And that just feeds discontent at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people do have this outlet, and it's a good outlet, and I don't actually think we would face a runaway convention. My thinking on that has shifted a little bit. But, you know, people in Washington need to pay attention to this.
John Vile.
I did not know about this example from Austin, but it reminds me of, we always associate federalism with the Southern cause, but long before federalism, we had the Hartford Convention, you know, where mm-hmm. the New England states were considering moving away. And we also had, you know, many northern states who were very reluctant, understandably, to enforce the Fugitive Slave Clause. So this is not a new phenomenon. If we go back to the founders' intentions, when you read through the debates at the Constitutional Convention, the interesting thing about the Article 5 Convention is that it was when they almost got through and they had a proposal essentially where amendments would all depend on Congress. And George Mason and others said, of course, they didn't have experience in knowing what the new Congress was going to do. But, you know, what if it turns out to be tyrannical? Are we going to leave them, you know, with all power? And the Article 5 amending process or the convention process from right or left does indicate that if Congress is unresponsive, and, you know, this is a lesson for them, if they are unresponsive, there are alternate means that can be used.
Stephen Griffin, John Vile, Sanford Levinson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, and more recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. John Vile is dean and professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, and the forthcoming Reframers, 170 Eccentric Visionary and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Stephen Griffin is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane Law School. He's the author of Long Wars in the Constitution and American Constitutionalism from Theory to Politics. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.